crime prevention. That term brings to mind car alarms, more policing, and anti-gang task forces. But a new report is helping take a broader look at the concept of crime prevention. Living on welfare in BC, experiences of long-term expected-to-work recipients followed more than 60 people over the span of 2 years. The report sheds light on some of the connections between current welfare policies and illegal activities that people engage in to survive. The report is published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives and the Raise the Rates Coalition. Seth Klein is the BC Director of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and he's the co-author of this new report. He joins us on the phone from his home in Vancouver. Thanks for joining us, Seth.
Hi, Emily.
Why did you want to take on this research?
Well, as many people know, the current government brought in a whole host of changes to welfare policy rules in 2002. There were rate cuts, cuts to actual benefit rates, but there were a whole bunch of rule changes that impacted eligibility for welfare and how hard it is to get welfare, which we examined more closely in a study we published a couple years ago called Denied Assistance. And then a whole bunch of rule changes that affect people who are already on assistance and just increased all the hoops that people have to jump through and all of the expectations and the sanctions when people fail to meet these obligations, these new rules. And it was a lot of the rules were particularly targeted at those who, according to the ministry, are considered expected to work, that they consider employable. And so we wanted to follow how people experience those rules and how they make ends meet. And we thought that the best way to do that would be to try to recruit a group of study participants who we could follow over 2 years and really get to know and track what kind of hardships they experience, how they make ends meet, and give us some ability to compare what happens to people who remain on social assistance over a period like that, what happens to people who leave voluntarily, and what happens to people who are kicked off. And we had all three people in all who experience all three scenarios.
You mentioned this focuses on people who are classified as expected to work, or ETW.
Mm-hmm.
So how is this classification applied, and how does it affect people living under that classification?
Well, interestingly, even though if you just look at a snapshot of the welfare caseload at any given time, most of the people now have disability status, but so aren't considered at least immediately employable. And yet, oddly, whenever somebody is in need and is applying for social assistance, their first point of entry is into the expected to work category, meaning even if you aren't actually employable, you still have to gain access to welfare on the assumption that you are. So that's where everyone starts. They have this in-between category that they call PPMB, Persons with Persistent Multiple Barriers to Employment. That's their lingo. And when someone has that status, they get a little bit more money, but mostly they get exempted from a lot of these work obligations. But you have to have been on social assistance for at least a year before you're even allowed to apply for that status. And getting disability status is a whole other order of difficulty. I mean, you already have to be on assistance, and you have to then apply, and you go, you know, there's like a 24-page application, and you need doctors have to fill out parts of it. And as all the groups that do advocacy for people with disabilities will tell you, that is a very onerous process. And that was true for a lot of the people in our study, many of whom ultimately got disability status, but it took years. And yet, from our interviews, it should have been obvious to the ministry years earlier that these people weren't actually employable, and yet they were held in that expected-to-work category, receiving the bare minimum of benefits that people are entitled to, and forced to jump through all of these employment hoops that were fundamentally inappropriate to their circumstances.
So it's hard enough to fight to even get on welfare, but once you're on welfare, then
you have to fight again.
It's another whole bureaucratic step there.
And at each stage, you know, both denied assistance, our earlier study, and now the Living on Welfare study, found that in very much, particularly if you're someone in need, particularly if you're someone who's wrestling with addiction or mental health issues, ironically, the harder it is to navigate this system on your own. And very often, what emerges from the research is that if you don't have the wherewithal or the good luck to connect with an advocate, someone in the community who knows all the intricacies of the rules to help you navigate that system, you very often simply walk away and you become homeless.
So you chose to look at people in this particular category expected to work. Was there a reason for that? You wanted to focus on that?
Well, as I was getting at earlier, because a lot of the key rule changes, the sort of big sticks that were brought in 2002, were focused on that category. And really, by doing it this way, we were able to, our objective was, in many respects, to test the government narrative. Because when you ask the government about welfare policy, they tell you it's just a great news story, that the caseloads are going down, and more people are leaving, and they're leaving for work, and those who remain are all getting disability status where they get more income and the support that they need, and all is well. And so we wanted to test the various elements of that narrative to figure out, well, who is leaving welfare, and why are the caseloads going down, and what happens to people when they leave or when they get kicked off? And even for those who get disability status, just how much better off are they? And so this study allowed us to test all of those things.
So how did the government do with their rating of their narrative?
Not very well. I mean, in all fairness to the government, we did, in our earlier study, we did an econometric exercise that tried to allow us to say, well, how much of the welfare caseload reduction can you reasonably say is due to the improved labor market and the lower unemployment rate? And, you know, you can explain about half of it. But the other half of the welfare caseload decline is about policy changes. And those are the people we're most interested in. And what both our earlier study showed and this study showed is that many of those who are leaving are not being diverted to employment, but in fact are being diverted to homelessness or survival sex or charities, and are having a very difficult time surviving. And importantly as well, in our study, this latest study, about a quarter of the people at the end of it had left voluntarily, and almost all of them were employed. And they saw a significant increase in their income, which isn't saying much because welfare rates are so low. And interestingly, even though they saw an increase in their income, most of them were still poor. In fact, all but four of them were still poor. And none of the single mothers in the study were above the poverty line. And so you stand back and you say, well, okay, if your measure of success is the government's measure of success, which is caseload reduction, then there's something to point to. But if your measure of success is poverty reduction, there's not much to crow about.
A single person on welfare was getting $510 a month. That was for a long time.
Yeah.
I know there was a recent increase, and it went up to $610.
That's right.
So that's, you know, $6 a day or something to live on after your $325 for shelter.
Yeah.
Under the old rates. So what kind of things did you find that people had to do in order to survive on that amount of money?
Well, it's virtually impossible to make ends meet on that amount of money. And, you know, it is true that while in the period that we were conducting the study, we were at the old welfare rates. And so when we published the study a couple weeks ago, the government and the minister's principal rejoinder was, oh, well, everything's better now. We increased welfare rates. But, of course, the $100 increase there for singles, all that did was undo the effect of inflation from the last 10 years because welfare rates had been frozen for that long. And it's still very hard to make ends meet. So to give you some examples of just how hard it is to make ends meet, at any given time every 6 months when we did full interviews in our studies, at each one of those stages, about a third of the participants reported being homeless at some point in the previous 6 months, which just gives you some indication of how hard it is to find housing with a welfare check. And it points to this connection between how low welfare rates are and the homelessness crisis that everybody is so anxious about. We asked questions about food security, and at the intake stage, the first round of interviews, people reported getting food from a food bank or a soup kitchen on average 11 times a month. And even at the end of the study, even when you look at the people who were still on assistance but had been upgraded to disability status, which again, you know, that's the government's good news story, well, they saw an improvement. They were now only using food banks or soup kitchens 4 times a month. Well, that's kind of a hollow victory. And you stand back and you look at it and you go, well, what does this mean when the public welfare system has become so structurally dependent on food banks and other charities in order for people to meet basic food needs? And then, I guess, with most relevance to your show, there are lots of cases in which these low rates force people to make really bad decisions in order to make ends meet. Specifically, of the women in the study who were in an intimate relationship, a third of them reported being in a relationship for financial reasons, and almost all of them experienced abuse at the hands of their partner. And so you see how low rates force people to make those kinds of decisions. One-fifth of all of the women in the study reported engaging in prostitution during the study, and in half of those cases, you could point to specific welfare policy rules that significantly contributed to that choice, whether it was being cut off welfare or the three-week wait or getting sanctioned in a cut in benefits that triggered that woman's decision at that point. And about a quarter of the participants overall reported engaging in some criminalized activity of some kind or another. And of those 7 people in our study who were cut off, almost every single one of them reported engaging in criminalized activity when they were cut off, because none of them had paid employment, and none of them were job ready, and none of them should have been cut off.
So that's a pretty direct link between the government's welfare policies and crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And even at a more kind of a somewhat less serious level, one of the rule changes that was made in 2002 was the elimination of earnings exemptions for people without disability status. So if you're in the expected to work category, we are now the only province, we're actually the only jurisdiction in North America that doesn't have any earnings exemptions. Those are the rules that would allow people to earn a little bit of money and keep some of it. Most of North America, everywhere else in North America, this is understood as both reasonable and understandable and necessary and, in fact, helpful to help people, you know, get a foot back in the labor market. But not in British Columbia. In British Columbia, if you're in the expected to work category and you earn income, you're supposed to declare it and get it dollar for dollar clawed off your welfare check. Well, what does it mean then if, as the study so clearly demonstrates, you can't actually make ends meet on a welfare check, and yet if you get some money by other means, abide by the rules and declare it, it's all clawed back. So the system effectively forces everyone at some level to act fraudulently.
In the sense that
because survival necessitates.
They don't report the money they're making because how else would they survive?
Right.
And I think that is a big focus of the mainstream, talking about welfare fraud and people scamming the system. So what else did you find in your research to sort of debunk that myth of welfare fraud?
Well, I mean, this kind of fraud is really small potatoes. I mean, this is just sort of survival. I think it's more accurately described as survival rule bending is what it is. To the extent, you know, the media does like to make a big deal about other kinds of welfare frauds by which they invoke, you know, these images of people, these welfare mothers who are collecting like 5 checks at multiple post office boxes and so on. And if that was ever true, and I doubt it was, it's not true anymore. The rules around the application process itself are so onerous, as we demonstrated in an earlier study, that's just not happening. Andrew McLeod, who is an investigative reporter who writes for the Taiyi and does some really excellent work on welfare policy, did a great piece a few months ago looking at the provincial government here and their attempt to crack down on welfare fraud. And they have 122 officers in the Ministry of Employment and Income Assistance who work in this department, which they call loss recovery. And last year they recouped $1 million, which is 0.1% of the budget that they spend on social assistance. Or put another way, of those 122 staff people, on average, they recouped $8,000, or a fraction of their own salary. And that supports actually every piece of research I've ever seen in Canada that's looked at welfare fraud, which is every single one of them found that any attempt to crack down on so-called welfare fraud costs more than it recouped.
So it's more about the ideology that plays mm-hmm. than the actual money. What surprised you most in doing this research and hearing these stories?
Well, I think that the level... anecdotally, we all know that women return to or stay in abusive relationships or engage in prostitution. I may have been an ingenue about this, but I did not expect to see it come up as often as it did in a study with a sample size like ours. So that was surprising. On the positive side, I think you spend 2 years following a group like this and you can't help but be impressed with how resilient people are. I think the degree of the reliance on the charitable sector was surprising. There were these 7 people who were cut off in our study, and I thought we might have 1 or 2 who were cut off. I did not think we would have 7, and I didn't think that their experiences would be as stark as they were, which is that every one of them who was cut off lived on no income virtually. They were all homeless, and none of them should have been cut off to a number. None of them belonged in the expected to work category, and if they hadn't been in that category, they wouldn't have been cut off. And it was all so through the looking glass, you know, just to share 2 stories. I mean, we changed everyone's names, but profiled some of the people, and there was one guy we call Frank who was cut off, who became homeless because he was cut off. He was one of the few who had stable housing and then was evicted because he was cut off. And he was also one of the few, they all wrestled with addiction issues in this group, but he was the one guy who'd been clean and dry for a few years, and he gets cut off and ends up going, you know, back to alcohol for the first time in years. And you just stand back and you go, nobody's being served by this. There was a case of a woman named, we called her Lorraine, who was cut off, became homeless, returns briefly to prostitution, and then to get out of prostitution, she goes back to her abusive ex-partner and ends up getting beaten up so badly she's hospitalized for a few months. And she, to put it crassly, she cost the healthcare system more in that period than welfare would have provided to her for a few years.
It's like that recent report, some researchers at SFU put out, that it costs less to give people housing than all the services are required when people don't have a place to live.
That's right. That's what that study showed, and that's what our study showed, that when you look at these individual circumstances and you think, what is this costing the healthcare system, the justice system, and just the charitable and social service sector because of inadequate rates and inflexible and arbitrary rules, and it doesn't compare.
And I think in order to figure out where we need to go with this kind of information, what we need to do, what we need to advocate for, I think we need to look at, you know, from our perspective here, all the resources that are put into the criminal justice system to deal with what happens after a crime is committed, opposed to the social supports. Your research shows one small piece of this in terms of the putting resources into those social supports that would prevent crime. What's the missing link there? Why, even if the research is there, what are the powers that be or the forces that are preventing that reallocation of resources, do you think?
It's a good question, and I can't explain it at the level of the policymakers. I mean, I think a lot of it's ideological, but I also think that you know, these studies do advise us that we can make some headway when we drive home the false economy argument that you were just making, right? That we're not actually saving the taxpayer money by allocating our resources the way that we are. And I do think it, I mean, there was this increase in welfare rates last year, and I think that's a real tribute to the work of groups like Raise the Rates and others and the kind of campaign that they ran and pressure in getting municipal governments to pass resolutions. There was a whole period there where the pressure was really building, and it got to the point that the province had to move. Now, it wasn't enough, but in a single year, it was pretty unusual to see a 10 to 20% increase in a single year. And, you know, the CCPA has done some interesting polling work on welfare and poverty issues, some focus group and polling work. We don't do a lot of this kind of stuff because it's expensive, but no one else does, so we like to. And what emerges from that polling work is that one of the challenges that we face with the general public is an information gap, but not a values gap, which is important, because if we faced a values gap, we'd be in some trouble. But just to give you an illustration, if you cold poll the public and say, should we increase welfare rates, we're kind of split right down the middle, 50-50, yes, no. But if you simply preface the question by telling people what welfare rates are, like just the dollar amount that people get, and then ask the question, 75% say increase them. But we're confronting a lot of myths out there about how generous welfare is and how easy it is to get and how easy it is to stay on. But when people hear the reality, it doesn't sit well with them. That's what I find when I go on radio shows on less friendly stations. They don't like it.
In terms of what we need to do short and long term, one of the things you're saying is education, getting that information out there, making those arguments with people.
I think that's an important piece. And then the mobilization piece. I mean, that's why I think the partnership that we have with a group like Raise the Rates is such a good one, because, you know, everyone has different pieces to it. We don't do a lot of mobilization work, and they do. And the combination of the two, I think, really helped to bring about some changes. I mean, even, you know, my experience with the ministry is it is possible to get them to move, particularly when they're confronted with certain realities like the increase in homelessness. They remain remarkably stubborn when it comes to certain rules and yet flexible when it comes to their implementation. So, for example, they take great pride now in the fact that 75% of applicants to welfare are now exempt from the 3-week wait, they claim. Now, that was not the case when we did our initial research, but now they say it is the case. Well, that's good, but then you want to say to them, okay, but what does it mean to have a rule that only works when 3/4 of the people who come present to you have to be exempt from it? So they won't change the rule, but they'll be flexible in other ways.
thanks very much for joining us and sharing some of what you've learned from your research.
Thanks, Emily. And people can see the whole study up on the CCPA webpage.
And that webpage is www.policyalternatives.ca. We've been speaking with Seth Klein, and he's one of the authors of a new report called Living on Welfare in BC, Experiences of Long-Term Expected to Work Recipients. And again, you can find it on the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives website at www.policyalternatives.ca.